This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
Imagine that I'd said to Nigel after an interview, "That was the best Philosophy Bites interview we've ever conducted." Perhaps I was being ironic or sarcastic, but perhaps I meant it literally. If you had more information, you might be able to work out my meaning, say if you'd heard my tone of voice, or if you'd been sitting in on the interview too. So what is the relationship between meaning and context? We spoke to Emma Borg. To put her into context, she's an expert on the philosophy of language.
Emma Borg, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is language and context. Now, what's context got to do with language?
Okay, I mean, that's a good question. So let's think about maybe a question that comes slightly before that. Let's think about what it would be to understand a language. And we might think, how is it when you learn a language like French or German or whatever, how is it that you understand the sentences or the expressions that you're being presented with? And one possibility, I guess, would be that what you've learnt when you're learning a language is something that pairs up the sentences of that language with the meaning in that language. So when someone presents you with a bit of this new language, what you do is you go to your big lookup list and you find the sentence in question and you pair it with the meaning, and that's it, you've got the meaning. That might be one way in which language learning could go, but it seems that after a moment's reflection, that can't be quite right. And it can't be quite right because language looks like it's got this quite surprising feature that we can just generate lots and lots, maybe even an indefinite or infinite number of sentences within just one natural language. So, you know, when you were learning French, you didn't just learn a few sentences, you learnt a potentially infinite number of sentences. You learnt how to say snow is white, but you also learnt how to say snow is white and grass is green, or snow is white and grass is green and 2 + 2 = 5. And we could just go on doing that. We could go on generating lots and lots of brand new sentences. And that seems to show us that you haven't just got a big lookup list, because one thing we know about the mind or about the brain is that it's not infinite. You can't have an infinite list of sentences in that way.
Well, in the case of me learning French, I was actually mapping the French onto English, so it was parasitic on my knowledge of English.
Okay, that's fine. So you might think in that case it was parasitic. But if we think about the first language that you learned, then say you were learning English as your first language, even so, it can't be the case that what you learned was an infinite set of sentences, because smart as we all are in this room, we still haven't got infinite minds in that way. So then we face this question, well, what do you know? How do you understand your language? And a suggestion that's been made, and it seems quite appealing, is that what you know are the meanings of some finite number of things, like the meanings of words, and you know some strategies or some rules for putting those words together in meaningful ways. So maybe that's what understanding a language consists in, just knowing word meaning and structures.
By structures, do you mean something like grammar?
Yeah, absolutely, something like grammar, something like the structure of a sentence for how bits relate to one another.
Okay, so you've got this grammar, you've got this vocabulary. Where does context come in?
Exactly. So now we can begin to think about the worry of context. Because that picture that what you learn are the meanings of words that are kind of stable and repeatable, plus these rules for putting those words together, that doesn't seem to have a place for context. But again, as soon as we start thinking about our language, we can see that there has to be a role for context. So, you know, when I say I'm happy, I say something different to what you say when you say I'm happy. In the one case, I say Emma's happy. In the other case, you say Nigel is happy. So what's going on in that kind of contextual shift? Or again, you know, if I say Nigel's sitting, looks like what I'm saying is Nigel is sitting at a particular time. So it looks like to get at meaning, we've got to have some kind of appeal to the context of utterance. We've got to know things like who's speaking, where they're speaking, when they're speaking, these kinds of features. So something in our knowledge of language has to capture that context sensitivity.
Presumably, you have to know even more than that. You have to know if they're playing a game or if they're with a friend joking or if they're deadly serious, if they're being ironic. And so on. There must be quite a lot of contextual things that feed into our interpretation of what a word or a sentence means.
Okay, so that's a good point. So thinking about these expressions, this kind of obvious points of context sensitivity, people had the impression that context sensitivity was quite a limited feature of our language. You know, maybe we need to think about context when we're dealing with words like I and this and that and today and tomorrow and tense markers. But maybe that's it. Maybe that was the kind of extent of context sensitivity in our language. And there were some very smart philosophers around, people like Kaplan and Stallnaker and Perry, who gave us a way of dealing with those kinds of expressions. They said, look, what you need to know when you're thinking about I or this or that is just a very simple contextual rule which will take you from that expression to the thing it's picking out in the context. So for I, what you know is that an utterance of I always refers to the speaker. And then you have to go to context to find out who the speaker is, but it's quite a rule-based kind of activity. So we might think of that kind of context sensitivity as sort of tame pragmatics or tame context sensitivity. But your question just now was, well, hang on, isn't there lots of other ways in which context gets in? And that's precisely the way that the debate has gone in recent years. People, in particular a philosopher called Charles Travis, have raised a number of examples which seem to show that context sensitivity is sort of pervasive in language.
Before we get on to Travis, I was just thinking about a phrase as simple as cat's eyes. If you're talking about that in relation to your pet, that's one thing. If you're talking about it as you're driving down the road, it's completely different.
I mean, we might genuinely think that cat's eyes has two different sort of dictionary entries. The cat's eyes you find on the road may well be actually recorded in a different way in a good dictionary. So we might think that that expression is genuinely ambiguous. But there are other cases where it's clear that we do get a sort of shift in meaning to do with the expressions that we're putting together. So there's a case that gets discussed a lot in the literature about the difference between bake a potato and bake a cake. So you do something different when you're baking a potato, you know, you're actually cooking this thing, whereas baking a cake means sort of creating it. There was no cake before you baked it, you're creating the thing. But you might think that's not such a weird kind of context sensitivity because it's emerging still from the expressions and the way they're put together, right? It's because in one case we've got a potato, in the other case we've got a cake. They're different kinds of things, so that could give rise to a difference of meaning in baking in each case.
Okay, you mentioned Charles Travis's examples that are supposed to demonstrate that context is incredibly important for understanding language. What are they?
Okay, so Travis has got these excellent cases and he can just generate you a case for almost any expression you give him. I'm not as good as that, so I'm just going to borrow one of his. He has this one very famous case, which is probably a good place to start. So he says, look, imagine this girl called Pia. And Pia has a Japanese maple tree. And as we all know, Japanese maple trees have red leaves. But one morning, Pia looks out of her window and sees her tree, and she comes to think that red is the wrong colour for leaves. She thinks leaves should really be green. So she goes out and she meticulously paints every single leaf on her Japanese maple in green. And Travis then says, well, look, consider now two different scenarios that Pia might be involved in. First scenario, a friend of hers who's an artist rings up and says, I'm about to paint a picture, but I need something green to balance out the composition. Have you got anything green I could borrow? And Pia says, looking at her painted leaves, yes, you can have these. These leaves are green. Okay, and Travis says, in that context, our intuitions are that Pia said something true. Speaking to the artist of the painted leaves, it's true to say that they're green. But he says, hang on, you know, imagine a second scenario in which a botanist friend of Pia's calls up and she says, look, Pia, I'm about to run an experiment on photosynthesis. Have you got any green leaves that I can have for my experiment? And Pia, looking at her painted leaves, says, yes, you can have these. These leaves are green. And Travis says, our intuitions in that case are that Pia has no longer said something true. Speaking of the painted leaves to the botanist, it's no longer correct to say of these leaves that they're green. And he says, look, we've got a single sentence, these leaves are green. The circumstances don't change. We're just talking about the same painted leaves. And yet in one context, we feel something true has been said. And in another context, we feel something false has been said. And that shows us that we've got context sensitivity where we didn't think we had it.
So that's supposed to show that context is everything for language. Mm-hmm. Does it really show that?
Okay, well, that is a $1 million question, isn't it? So these kinds of cases have given rise to an immense amount of different positions in the literature. Some of them absolutely endorse Travis's position that these cases show us that context is all pervasive and we should think about language in a much more kind of Wittgensteinian picture. We shouldn't think of getting at meaning as combining stable meanings in certain kinds of repeatable ways. Really, we should think about language as a tool that we use and we need to know about the purpose for which that tool is being deployed. And so context is really everything. So that's one position. That's Travis's kind of position in the literature. I've adopted a position at the other extreme where I try and argue that these cases don't show us that context is all pervasive. And to get at that kind of strategy, I think we need to do a couple of things. So we need to think very carefully about each of the cases Travis gives us, because it's not clear that the same thing will be going on in every single case. So, for instance, there's been quite a lot of work in linguistics about whether colour terms are actually ambiguous, and maybe that's what's coming out in that peer example. And there might be other things going on in some of the other cases that Travis gives us. But the general kind of motto of minimalism is that these sorts of thought experiments aren't the right place to be looking when we're trying to think about literal meaning, because they're just too complicated and too infected by all the different features we bring to bear when we're trying to interpret one another to abstract out literal meaning.
So minimalism, as you're describing it, is this notion that you can have a literal meaning of a sentence, and that meaning is given by the words and their arrangement within a grammatical order, and that the context can be relevant but isn't the determining factor of meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. So minimalists are driven by those kinds of concerns we talked about earlier about learnability and systematicity. And they think, look, if you haven't got something kind of fixed and stable and unchanging, you're not going to be able to explain those features of language. And then combined with that, they think back to a very influential philosopher in this area who was Paul Grice, an Oxford philosopher, who drew a really clear distinction between sentence meaning and what speakers can say when they produce those sentences. So a kind of famous case from Grice, he asked us to consider a letter of reference that's being written for someone. And he's writing a letter of reference for one of his students, and he just writes one sentence: Jones has nice handwriting. And the thought is that if Jones has been applying for a philosophy job and that's the letter of reference you write for him, then the message you convey to somebody is going to be something like, Jones is not a good philosopher, or Jones shouldn't be given this job. But Grice says, even if that's right, we're not tempted to think that the sentence, Jones has nice handwriting, could ever literally mean Jones has no philosophical talent, okay? There's a difference between what a sentence means and what a speaker conveys by it. And what minimalists want to say is, look, these Travis cases are very nice, but at least some of them are just trading on that old distinction between sentence meaning and speaker meaning.
Why do you call this minimalism?
The main reason I call it minimalism is that it adopts a very minimal job description for semantics. So there used to be an assumption, which maybe wasn't always spelled out, that what we wanted from a semantic theory, a theory of literal meaning, was that it captured our intuitions about speech act content, that it would tell us what someone has said when they produce one of these sentences. And a minimalist for me is someone who says, well, no, that's too rich a job description. A semantic theory couldn't do that at the same time it was trying to capture these facts about learnability and systematicity, because, you know, speech act content is affected by a whole range of things. You need to know about encyclopedic knowledge. You need to know about socioeconomic status. You need to know about all these kinds of things about the person you're talking to in order to really get at what message they're trying to get across. So the minimalist says, no, we should think about semantics as just a very limited, constrained kind of activity. It's just trying to get at literal meaning. And then literal meaning plays a part in working out what someone has said, but it certainly doesn't exhaust it.
I was going to ask that question. What is the role for literal meaning? You've hinted at it, but you discover that literal meaning is all about the way in which parts of a sentence fit together grammatically, but it's not the whole story. What is it?
Okay, so I think there are a range of ways in which minimal meanings or literal meanings are going to be useful. I should say, though, that that's a very good question, because one of the objections that's made to my position is, oh, well, you can have minimal contents, but they're completely redundant. Why would you want them? And, you know, I think it's right that minimal meanings don't do all the really nice things that we might have thought semantic content was going to do for us, but they do still have some role to play. So, for instance, if you think about when things go wrong, so sometimes you're having a conversation with somebody and you suddenly realise that you don't really know what they're saying to you, or, you know, there's some aspect of the context that you don't know about and it's stopping you from getting the whole meaning. So in that case, what can you do? Well, the only thing you can do is fall back on the literal meaning. Okay, so I think to myself, I don't really know what Nigel said when he uttered that sentence. I don't really know what he meant, what he was trying to get across to me, but I still know that he said a given sentence with a given literal meaning. So I can fall back to that kind of content. You know, if you spend much time with children or philosophers or lawmakers, you will find they're very good at accessing that level of content. So, you know, when I say to my 7-year-old child, give some of that cake to your brother, he's very good at passing just the tiniest fragment over. And what that shows is that he's exploiting the literal meaning. He knows full well that's not what I meant. I meant give some reasonable portion of it. But he's got a nice grip on what the minimal content was, and he's going to exploit it. So minimal contents do have a role to play in that sort of exchange. And also, if we think about legal exchanges, there are some cases where it's very important that we just get at what someone is committed to by the words that she says, rather than kind of the way she says them or the background context. And then the final point where I think minimalism is important is that these different theories about the role of context might tell us something about the nature of the mind as well. They might tell us about the relationship between language understanding and other kinds of cognitive activity that we engage in.
Obviously, particularly philosophers, thinking about the mind, think about language because they think about the mind in language, and they are fairly logocentric to start with. They're not thinking about images typically. But what does your understanding of language have to say about the mind?
So my view of language has some quite clear repercussions for what we want to say about the mind. So minimalism claims that when you understand a language, what you understand are the meanings of these primitives, the words, and a way of putting those words together to generate meanings for complexes. But if that's all that's involved in understanding a language, then we could have some quite dedicated part of the mind which is responsible for understanding that. We could have what someone like Jerry Fodor has called a module. So a module is supposed to be an encapsulated computational system which doesn't look to everything that you as an individual know. It just looks to a very small subset, a set of rules and a library of information. And minimalism says that maybe language understanding is like that, and so could be underpinned by a dedicated module. And that might fit nicely with some cases where things go wrong. So we know that in some kinds of cases of impairment, what happens is that your language understanding either gets impaired or preserved, while your general understanding, your kind of pragmatic understanding, is either preserved or lost in a different way. So if we think about maybe some cases on the autistic spectrum, high-functioning autistic spectrum patients known as Asperger's syndrome, they have a very well-preserved language ability, and they tend to be over-literal. They access the literal meanings of sentences, but they're not so good at picking up on the conveyed, communicated content. And what the minimalist takes those kinds of cases to show is that maybe that's reflecting a structure of the mind. We could preserve the module that underpins language understanding when there's damage occurring in other areas of the mind.
Academics are often asked to defend what they do to a wider public. How could you possibly do that? You're just reflecting on the nature of language here.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's a really good question. We need to justify why we're doing what we're doing. But I do think this issue is one that we can definitely find reason for studying. So one reason is just its kind of inherent interest. These things are activities that we engage in every day. We talk to one another, we get the message. But how does that work? These things are very up close and personal, and it would be good to understand what's going on. But a second reason that these things matter is that if we think about the impairment cases we were talking about a moment ago, it looks as if we're going to be able to design the best kind of interventions for those sorts of troubles, we need, first of all, to know what's going on when things go right. If we want to understand what's going on when things go wrong, we need to know how they compare with typical language development. So a good theoretical understanding of language matters for treating those kinds of concerns. And if we think about all the developments that are going on at the moment with brain scans and advances in science, it seems to me that none of those results are going to be fully robust unless we've got a good theoretical model to plug them into. If we want to know why it's useful to understand that this bit of your brain lights up when you're listening to a language and this bit of your brain lights up when you're doing something else, we need to know about the theoretical structures that they plug into. And that's what philosophy in general delivers for you.
Emma Borg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.